Percy, you know who you remind me of most? Thalia. You guys are so much alike, it's scary. I mean, either you would have been best friends, or you would have strangled each other. Let's go with best friends. Thalia got angry with her dad sometimes. So do you. Would you turn against Olympus because of that? I stared at the quiver of arrows in the corner. No. Okay, then. Neither would she. Luke's wrong. Annabeth stuck her knife blade into the dirt. I wanted to ask her about the prophecy Luke had mentioned and what it had to do with my 16th birthday, but I figured she wouldn't tell me. Chiron had made it pretty clear that I wasn't allowed to hear it until the gods decided otherwise. So what did Luke mean about Cyclopes? I asked. He said you of all people? I know what he said. He was talking about the real reason Thalia died. I waited, not sure what to say. Annabeth drew a shaky breath. You can never trust the Cyclops, Percy. 6 years ago, on the night Grover was leading us to Half-Blood Hill... She was interrupted when the door of the hut creaked open. Tyson crawled in.
Powder donuts,
he said proudly, holding up a pastry box. Annabeth stared at him. Where did you get that? We're in the middle of the wilderness. There's nothing around for...
50 feet, Tyson said. Monster donut shop, just over the hill.
This is bad, Annabeth muttered. We were crouching behind a tree, staring at the donut shop in the middle of the woods. It looked brand new, with brightly lit windows, a parking area, and a little road leading off into the forest, but there was nothing else around, and no cars parked in the lot. We could see one employee reading a magazine behind the cash register. That was it. On the store's marquee, in huge black letters that even I could read, it said, Monster Donut. A cartoon ogre was taking a bite out of the O in Monster. The place smelled good, like fresh baked chocolate donuts. This shouldn't be here, Annabeth whispered. It's wrong. What? I asked. It's a donut shop. Shh! Why are we whispering? Tyson went in and bought a dozen. Nothing happened to him. He's a monster. Oh, come on, Annabeth. Monster Donut doesn't mean monsters. It's a chain. We've got them in New York. A chain, she agreed. And don't you think it's strange that one appeared immediately after you told Tyson to get donuts? Right here in the middle of the woods? I thought about it. It did seem a little weird, but, I mean, donut shops weren't real high on my list of sinister forces. It could be a nest, Annabeth explained. Tyson whimpered. I doubt he understood what Annabeth was saying any better than I did, but her tone was making him nervous. He plowed through half a dozen donuts from his box and was getting powdered sugar all over his face. A nest for what? I asked. Haven't you ever wondered how franchise stores pop up so fast? She asked. One day there's nothing, and then the next day, boom, there's a new burger place or a coffee shop or whatever. First a single store, then two, then four, exact replicas spreading across the country? No, never thought about it. Percy, some of the chains multiply so fast because all their locations are magically linked to the life force of a monster. Some children of Hermes figured out how to do it back in the 1950s. They breed... She froze. What? I demanded. They breed what? No sudden moves, Annabeth said, like her life depended on it. Very slowly, turn around. Then I heard it, a scraping noise, like something large dragging its belly through the leaves. I turned and saw a rhino-sized thing moving through the shadows of the trees. It was hissing, its front half writhing in all different directions. I couldn't understand what I was seeing at first. Then I realized the thing had multiple necks, at least 7, each topped with a hissing reptilian head. Its skin was leathery, and under each neck it wore a plastic bib that read, "I'm a monster donut kid." I took out my ballpoint pen, but Annabeth locked eyes with me. A silent warning. Not yet. I understood. A lot of monsters have terrible eyesight. It was possible the Hydra might pass us by. But if I uncapped my sword now, the bronze glow would certainly get its attention. We waited. The Hydra was only a few feet away. It seemed to be sniffing the ground and the trees like it was hunting for something. Then I noticed that 2 of the heads were ripping apart a piece of yellow canvas. One of our duffel bags. The thing had already been to our campsite. It was following our scent. My heart pounded. I'd seen a stuffed Hydra head trophy at camp before, but that did nothing to prepare me for the real thing. Each head was diamond-shaped, like a rattlesnake's, but the mouths were lined with jagged rows of shark-like teeth. Tyson was trembling. He stepped back and accidentally snapped a twig. Immediately, all 7 heads turned toward us and hissed. "Scatter!" Annabeth yelled. She dove to the right. I rolled to the left. One of the Hydra heads spat an arc of green liquid that shot past my shoulder and splashed against an elm. The trunk smoked and began to disintegrate. The whole tree toppled straight toward Tyson, who still hadn't moved, petrified by the monster that was now right in front of him. "Tyson!" I tackled him with all my might, knocking him aside just as the Hydra lunged and the tree crashed on top of 2 of its heads. The Hydra stumbled backward, yanking its heads free, then wailing in outrage at the fallen tree. All 7 heads shot acid, and the elm melted into a steaming pool of muck. "Move!" I told Tyson. I ran to one side and uncapped Riptide, hoping to draw the monster's attention. It worked. The sight of celestial bronze is hateful to most monsters. As soon as my glowing blade appeared, the Hydra whipped toward it with all its heads, hissing and baring its teeth. The good news? Tyson was momentarily out of danger. The bad news? I was about to be melted into a puddle of goo. One of the heads snapped at me experimentally. Without thinking, I swung my sword. "No!" Annabeth yelled. Too late. I sliced the Hydra's head clean off. It rolled away into the grass, leaving a flailing stump, which immediately stopped bleeding and began to swell like a balloon. In a matter of seconds, the wounded neck split into 2 necks, each of which grew a full-size head. Now I was looking at an 8-headed Hydra. "Percy!" Annabeth scolded. "You just opened another monster donut shop somewhere!" I dodged a spray of acid. "I'm about to die, and you're worried about that? How do we kill it?" "Fire!" Annabeth said. "We have to have fire!" As soon as she said that, I remembered the story. The Hydra's heads would only stop multiplying if we burned the stumps before they regrew. That's what Heracles had done, anyway, but we had no fire. I backed up toward the river. The Hydra followed. Annabeth moved in on my left and tried to distract one of the heads, parrying its teeth with her knife. But another head swung sideways like a club and knocked her into the muck.
"No hitting my friends."
Tyson charged in, putting himself between the Hydra and Annabeth. As Annabeth got to her feet, Tyson started smashing at the monster heads with his fists so fast it reminded me of the whack-a-mole game at the arcade. But even Tyson couldn't fend off the Hydra forever. We kept inching backward, dodging acid splashes and deflecting snapping heads without cutting them off. But I knew we were only postponing our deaths. Eventually, we would make a mistake and the thing would kill us. Then I heard a strange sound, a chug, 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 that at first I thought was my heartbeat. It was so powerful, it made the riverbank shake. "What's that noise?" Annabeth shouted, keeping her eyes on the hydra.
"Steam engine," Tyson said.
"What?" I ducked as the hydra spat acid over my head. Then from the river behind us, a familiar female voice shouted, "There! Prepare the 32-pounder!" I didn't dare look away from the hydra, but if that was who I thought it was behind us, I figured we now had enemies on two fronts. A gravelly male voice said,
"They're too close, m'lady."
"Damn the heroes," the girl said. "Full steam ahead."
"Aye, m'lady."
"Fire at will, captain."
Annabeth understood what was happening a split second before I did. She yelled, "Hit the dirt!" And we dove for the ground as an earth-shattering boom echoed from the river. There was a flash of light, a column of smoke, and the hydra exploded right in front of us, showering us with nasty green slime that vaporized as soon as it hit, the way monster guts tend to do.
"Gross!" screamed Annabeth.
"Steamship!"
yelled Tyson. I stood, coughing from the cloud of gunpowder smoke that was rolling across the banks. Chugging toward us down the river was the strangest ship I'd ever seen. It rode low in the water like a submarine, its deck plated with iron. In the middle was a trapezoid-shaped casemate with slats on each side for cannons. A flag waved from the top, a wild boar and spear on a blood-red field. Lining the deck were zombies in gray uniforms, dead soldiers with shimmering faces that only partially covered their skulls, like the ghouls I'd seen in the underworld guarding Hades' palace. The ship was an ironclad, a Civil War battlecruiser. I could just make out the name along the prow in moss-covered letters, CSS Birmingham. And standing next to the smoking cannon that had almost killed us, wearing full Greek battle armor, was Clarice.
"Losers," she sneered. "But I suppose I have to rescue you. Come aboard."
Chapter 11. Clarice blows up everything.
"You are in so much trouble," Clarice said.
"We just finished a ship tour we didn't want, through dark rooms overcrowded with dead sailors. We'd seen the coal bunker, the boilers and engine, which huffed and groaned like it would explode any minute. We'd seen the pilot house and the powder magazine and gunnery deck, Clarice's favorite. With two Dahlgren smoothbore cannons on the port and starboard sides and a Brook 9-inch rifled gun fore and aft, all specially refitted to fire celestial bronze cannonballs. Everywhere we went, dead Confederate sailors stared at us, their ghostly bearded faces shimmering over their skulls. They approved of Annabeth because she told them she was from Virginia. They were interested in me, too, because my name was Jackson, like the Southern General. But then I ruined it by telling them I was from New York. They all hissed and muttered curses about Yankees. Tyson was terrified of them. All through the tour, he insisted Annabeth hold his hand, which she didn't look too thrilled about. Finally, we were escorted to dinner. The CSS Birmingham captain's quarters were about the size of a walk-in closet, but still much bigger than any other room on board. The table was set with white linen and china. Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, potato chips, and Dr. Peppers were served by skeletal crewmen. I didn't want to eat anything served by ghosts, but my hunger overruled my fear.
"Tantalus expelled you for eternity," Clarice told us smugly. Mr. D said if any of you show your face at camp again, he'll turn you into squirrels and run you over with his SUV.
Did they give you this ship? I asked.
Course not. My father did.
Ares?
Clarice sneered. You think your daddy is the only one with sea power? The spirits on the losing side of every war owe a tribute to Ares. That's their curse for being defeated. I prayed to my father for a naval transport, and here it is. These guys will do anything I tell them, won't you, Captain?
The captain stood behind her looking stiff and angry. His glowing green eyes fixed me with a hungry stare.
If it means an end to this infernal war, ma'am, peace at last, we'll do anything. Destroy anyone.
Clarice smiled.
Destroy anyone. I like that.
Tyson gulped.
Clarice?
Annabeth said. Luke might be after the fleece, too. We saw him. He's got the coordinates, and he's heading south. He has a cruise ship full of monsters.
Good. I'll blow him out of the water.
You don't understand, Annabeth said. We have to combine forces. Let us help you.
No.
Clarice pounded the table.
This is my quest, smart girl. Finally, I get to be the hero, and you two will not steal my chance.
Where are your cabin mates? I asked. You were allowed to take two friends with you, weren't you?
They didn't. I let them stay behind, to protect the camp.
You mean, even the people in your own cabin wouldn't help you?
Shut up, Prissy. I don't need them, or you.
Clarice, I said, Tantalus is using you. He doesn't care about the camp. He'd love to see it destroyed. He's setting you up to fail.
No, I don't care what the Oracle...
She stopped herself.
What?
I said. What did the Oracle tell you?
Nothing.
Clarice's ears turned pink.
All you need to know is that I'm finishing this quest and you are not helping. On the other hand, I can't let you go.
So, we're prisoners? Annabeth asked.
Guests, for now.
Clarice propped her feet up on the white linen tablecloth and opened another Dr. Pepper.
Captain, take them below. Assign them hammocks on the berth deck. If they don't mind their manners, show them how we deal with enemy spies.
The dream came as soon as I fell asleep. Grover was sitting at his loom, desperately unraveling his wedding train, when the boulder door rolled aside and the Cyclops bellowed,
"Uh-huh."
Grover yelped,
"Dear, I didn't... You were so quiet."
"Unraveling?" Polyphemus roared. "So that's the problem."
"Oh, no, I wasn't."
"Come."
Polyphemus grabbed Grover around the waist and half-carried, half-dragged him through the tunnels of the cave. Grover struggled to keep his high heels on his hooves. His veil kept tilting on his head, threatening to come off. The Cyclops pulled him into a warehouse-sized cavern decorated with sheep junk. There was a wool-covered Lazy Boy recliner and a wool-covered television set, crude bookshelves loaded with sheep collectibles, coffee mugs shaped like sheep faces, plaster figurines of sheep, sheep board games, and picture books and action figures. The floor was littered with piles of sheep bones and other bones that didn't look exactly like sheep, the bones of satyrs who'd come to the island looking for Pan. Polyphemus set Grover down only long enough to move another huge boulder. Daylight streamed into the cave, and Grover whimpered with longing. Fresh air! The Cyclops dragged him outside to a hilltop overlooking the most beautiful island I'd ever seen. It was shaped kind of like a saddle cut in half by an axe. There were lush green hills on either side and a wide valley in the middle, split by a deep chasm that was spanned by a rope bridge. Beautiful streams rolled to the edge of the canyon and dropped off in rainbow-colored waterfalls. Parrots fluttered in the trees. Pink and purple flowers bloomed on the bushes. Hundreds of sheep grazed in the meadows, their wool glinting strangely like copper and silver coins. And at the center of the island, right next to the rope bridge, was an enormous twisted oak tree with something glittering in its lowest bough. The Golden Fleece. Even in a dream, I could feel its power radiating across the island, making the grass greener, the flowers more beautiful. I could almost smell the nature magic at work. I could only imagine how powerful the scent would be for a satyr. Grover whimpered.
Yes, Polyphemus said proudly. See over there? Fleece is the prize of my collection. Stole it from heroes long ago, and ever since, free food. Satyrs come from all over the world, like moths to flame. Satyrs good eating, and now...
Polyphemus scooped up a wicked set of bronze shears. Grover yelped, but Polyphemus just picked up the nearest sheep like it was a stuffed animal and shaved off its wool. He handed a fluffy mass of it to Grover.
Put that on the spinning wheel, he said proudly. Magic cannot be unraveled.
Oh, well.
Poor Honey Pie, Polyphemus grinned. Bad weaver, ha ha. Not to worry. That thread will solve problem. Finish wedding train by tomorrow.
Isn't that thoughtful of you?
Hee-hee.
But dear, Grover gulped, what if someone were to rescue, I mean, attack this island?
Grover looked straight at me, and I knew he was asking for my benefit.
What would keep them from marching right up here to your cave?
Wifey scared. So cute. Not to worry. Polyphemus has state-of-the-art security system. Have to get through my pets.
Pets?
Grover looked across the island, but there was nothing to see except sheep grazing peacefully in the meadows.
And then, Polyphemus growled, they would have to get through me.
He pounded his fist against the nearest rock, which cracked and split in half.
Now come, he shouted, back to the cave.
Grover looked about ready to cry, so close to freedom, but so hopelessly far. Tears welled in his eyes as the boulder door rolled shut, sealing him once again in the stinky, torchlit dankness of the Cyclops' cave. I woke to alarm bells ringing throughout the ship. The captain's gravelly voice,
All hands on deck! Find Lady Clarice! Where is that girl?
Then his ghostly face appeared above me.
Get up, Yankee! Your friends are already above. We are approaching the entrance.
The entrance to what? He gave me a skeletal smile.
The Sea of Monsters, of course.
I stuffed my few belongings that had survived the Hydra into a sailor's canvas knapsack and slung it over my shoulder. I had a sneaking suspicion that one way or another, I would not be spending another night aboard the CSS Birmingham. I was on my way upstairs when something made me freeze, a presence nearby. Something familiar and unpleasant. For no particular reason, I felt like picking a fight. I wanted to punch a dead Confederate. The last time I felt like that kind of anger. Instead of going up, I crept to the edge of the ventilation grate and peered down into the boiler deck. Clarice was standing right below me, talking to an image that shimmered in the steam from the boilers. A muscular man in black leather biker clothes, with a military haircut, red-tinted sunglasses, and a knife strapped to his side. My fists clenched. It was my least favorite Olympian. Ares, the god of war.
I don't want excuses, little girl, he growled.
Yes, father, Clarice mumbled.
You don't want to see me mad, do you?
No, father.
No, father, Ares mimicked. You're pathetic. I should have let one of my sons take this quest.
I'll succeed,
Clarice promised, her voice trembling.
I'll make you proud.
You better, he warned. You asked me for this quest, girl. If you let that slimeball Jackson kid steal it from you.
But the Oracle said...
I don't care what it said.
Ares bellowed with such force that his image shimmered.
You will succeed, and if you don't...
He raised his fist. Even though he was only a figure in the steam, Clarice flinched.
Do we understand each other?
Ares growled. The alarm bells rang again. I heard voices coming toward me, officers yelling orders to ready the cannons. I crept back from the ventilation grate and made my way upstairs to join Annabeth and Tyson on the spar deck. What's wrong? Annabeth asked me. Another dream? I nodded, but I didn't say anything. I didn't know what to think about what I'd seen downstairs. It bothered me almost as much as the dream about Grover. Clarice came up the stairs right after me. I tried not to look at her. She grabbed a pair of binoculars from a zombie officer and peered toward the horizon.
At last! Captain, full steam ahead!
I looked in the same direction as she was, but I couldn't see much. The sky was overcast. The air was hazy and humid, like steam from an iron. If I squinted real hard, I could just make out a couple of dark, fuzzy splotches in the distance. My nautical senses told me we were somewhere off the coast of northern Florida, so we'd come a long way overnight, farther than any mortal ship should have been able to travel. The engine groaned as we increased speed. Tyson muttered nervously,
"Too much strain on the pistons. Not meant for deep water."
I wasn't sure how he knew that, but it made me nervous. After a few more minutes, the dark splotches ahead of us came into focus. To the north, a huge mass of rock rose out of the sea. An island with cliffs at least 100 feet tall. About half a mile south of that, the other patch of darkness was a storm brewing. The sky and sea boiled together in a roaring mass.
Hurricane? Annabeth asked. No, Clarice said. Charybdis.
Annabeth paled.
Are you crazy? Only way into the Sea of Monsters, straight between Charybdis and her sister Scylla.
Clarice pointed to the top of the cliffs, and I got the feeling something lived up there that I did not want to meet. What do you mean, the only way? I asked. The sea is wide open. Just sail around them. Clarice rolled her eyes.
Don't you know anything? If I tried to sail around them, they would just appear in my path again. If you want to get into the Sea of Monsters, you have to sail through them.
What about the Clashing Rocks? Annabeth said. That's another gateway. Jason used it.
I can't blow apart rocks with my cannons, Clarice said. Monsters, on the other hand.
You are crazy, Annabeth decided.
Watch and learn, wise girl.
Clarice turned to the captain.
Set course for Charybdis.
Aye, m'lady.
The engine groaned. The iron plating rattled, and the ship began to pick up speed.
Clarice, I said, Charybdis sucks up the sea, isn't that the story?
And spits it back out again, yeah.
What about Scylla?
She lives in a cave up on those cliffs. If we get too close, her snaky heads will come down and start plucking sailors off the ship.
Choose Scylla, then, I said. Everybody goes below deck, and we chug right past.
No, Clarice insisted. If Scylla doesn't get her easy meat, she might pick up the whole ship. Besides, she's too high to make a good target. My cannons can't shoot straight up. Charybdis just sits there at the center of her whirlwind. We're going to steam straight toward her, train our guns on her, and blow her to Tartarus.
She said it with such relish, I almost wanted to believe her. The engine hummed. The boilers were heating up so much, I could feel the deck getting warm beneath my feet. The smokestacks billowed, the Red Ares flag whipped in the wind. As we got closer to the monsters, the sound of Charybdis got louder and louder. A horrible wet roar like the galaxy's biggest toilet being flushed. Every time Charybdis inhaled, the ship shuddered and lurched forward. Every time she exhaled, we rose in the water and were buffeted by 10-foot waves. I tried to time the whirlpool. As near as I could figure, it took Charybdis about 3 minutes to suck up and destroy everything within a half-mile radius. To avoid her, we would have to skirt right next to Scylla's cliffs, and as bad as Scylla might be, those cliffs were looking awfully good to me. Undead sailors calmly went about their business on the spar deck. I guess they'd fought a losing cause before, so this didn't bother them. Or maybe they didn't care about getting destroyed because they were already deceased. Neither thought made me feel any better. Annabeth stood next to me, gripping the rail.
You still have your thermos full of wind?
I nodded. But it's too dangerous to use with a whirlpool like that. More wind might just make things worse.
What about controlling the water? She asked. You're Poseidon's son. You've done it before.
She was right. I closed my eyes and tried to calm the sea. But I couldn't concentrate. Charybdis was too loud and powerful. The waves wouldn't respond.
I can't, I said miserably.
We need a backup plan, Annabeth said. This isn't going to work.
Annabeth is right, Tyson said. Engine's no good.
What do you mean? She asked.
Pressure. Pistons need fixing.
Before he could explain, the cosmic toilet flushed with a mighty roar. The ship lurched forward, and I was thrown to the deck. We were in the whirlpool.
Full reverse!
Clarice screamed above the noise. The sea churned around us, waves crashing over the deck. The iron plating was now so hot it steamed.
Get us within firing range! Make ready, starboard cannons!
Dead Confederates rushed back and forth. The propeller grinded into reverse, trying to slow the ship, but we kept sliding toward the center of the vortex. A zombie sailor burst out of the hold and ran to Clarice. His gray uniform was smoking. His beard was on fire.
Boiler room overheating, ma'am. She's gonna blow.
Well, get down there and fix it.
Can't,
the sailor yelled.
We're vaporizing in the heat.
Clarice pounded the side of the casemate.
All I need is a few more minutes, just enough to get in range.
We're going in too fast,
the captain said grimly.
Prepare yourself for death.
No, Tyson bellowed. I can fix it.
Clarice looked at him incredulously.
You?
He's a cyclops, Annabeth said. He's immune to fire, and he knows mechanics.
Go,
yelled Clarice.
Tyson, no!
I grabbed his arm.
It's too dangerous.
He patted my hand.
Only way, brother.
His expression was determined, confident, even. I'd never seen him look like this before.
I will fix it. Be right back.
As I watched him follow the smoldering sailor down the hatch, I had a terrible feeling. I wanted to run after him, but the ship lurched again, and then I saw Charybdis. She appeared only a few hundred yards away, through a swirl of mist and smoke and water. The first thing I noticed was the reef, a black crag of coral with a fig tree clinging to the top, an oddly peaceful thing in the middle of a maelstrom. All around it, water curved into a funnel, like light around a black hole. Then I saw the horrible thing anchored to the reef just below the waterline, an enormous mouth with slimy lips and mossy teeth the size of rowboats. And worse, the teeth had braces, bands of corroded, scummy metal with pieces of fish and driftwood and floating garbage stuck between them. Charybdis was an orthodontist's nightmare. She was nothing but a huge black maw with bad teeth alignment and a serious overbite. And she'd done nothing for centuries but eat without brushing after meals. As I watched, the entire sea around her was sucked into the void. Sharks, schools of fish, a giant squid. And I realized that in a few seconds, the CSS Birmingham would be next.
"Lady Clarice," the captain shouted. "Starboard and forward guns are in range."
"Fire!"
Clarice ordered. 3 rounds were blasted into the monster's maw. 1 blew off the edge of an incisor. Another disappeared into her gullet. The 3rd hit one of Charybdis's retaining bands and shot back at us, snapping the Ares flag off its pole.
"Again!"
Clarice ordered. The gunners reloaded. But I knew it was hopeless. We would have to pound the monster 100 more times to do any real damage, and we didn't have that long. We were being sucked in too fast. Then the vibrations in the deck changed. The hum of the engine got stronger and steadier. The ship shuddered, and we started pulling away from the mouth.
"Tyson did it," Annabeth said.
"Wait," Clarice said. "We need to stay close."
"We'll die," I said. "We have to move away." I gripped the rail as the ship fought against the suction. The broken Ares flag raced past us and lodged in Charybdis's braces. We weren't making much progress, but at least we were holding our own. Tyson had somehow given us just enough juice to keep the ship from being sucked in. Suddenly, the mouth snapped shut. The sea died to absolute calm. Water washed over Charybdis. Then, just as quickly as it had closed, the mouth exploded open, spitting out a wall of water, ejecting everything inedible, including our cannonballs, one of which slammed into the side of the CSS Birmingham with a ding like the bell on a carnival game. We were thrown backward on a wave that must have been 40 feet high. I used all of my willpower to keep the ship from capsizing, but we were still spinning out of control, hurtling toward the cliffs on the opposite side of the strait. Another smoldering sailor burst out of the hold. He stumbled into Clarice, almost knocking them both overboard.
"The engine is about to blow."
"Where's Tyson?" I demanded.
"Still down there," the sailor said. "Holding it together somehow, though I don't know for how much longer."
The captain said,
"We have to abandon ship."
"No,"
Clarice yelled.
"We have no choice, m'lady. The hull is already cracking apart. She can't..."
He never finished his sentence. Quick as lightning, something brown and green shot from the sky, snatched up the captain, and lifted him away. All that was left were his leather boots.
"Silva!"
a sailor yelled, as another column of reptilian flesh shot from the cliffs and snapped him up. It happened so fast, it was like watching a laser beam rather than a monster. I couldn't even make out the thing's face, just a flash of teeth and scales. I uncapped Riptide and tried to swipe at the monster as it carried off another deckhand, but I was way too slow.
"Everyone get below!" I yelled.
"We can't!"
Clarice drew her own sword.
"Below deck is in flames!"
"Lifeboats!"
Annabeth said.
"Quick!"
"They'll never get clear of the cliffs," Clarice said. "We'll all be eaten!"
We have to try. Percy, the thermos. I can't leave Tyson. We have to get the boats ready.
Clarice took Annabeth's command. She and a few of her undead sailors uncovered one of the two emergency rowboats while Scylla's heads rained from the sky like a meteor shower with teeth, picking off Confederate sailors one after another.
Get the other boat!
I threw Annabeth the thermos.
I'll get Tyson.
You can't, she said. The heat will kill you. I didn't listen. I ran for the boiler room hatch when suddenly my feet weren't touching the deck anymore. I was flying straight up, the wind whistling in my ears, the side of the cliff only inches from my face. Scylla had somehow caught me by the knapsack and was lifting me up toward her lair. Without thinking, I swung my sword behind me and managed to jab the thing in her beady yellow eye. She grunted and dropped me. The fall would have been bad enough, considering I was 100 feet in the air, but as I fell, the CSS Birmingham exploded below me.
Karoom!
The engine room blew, sending chunks of ironclad flying in either direction like a fiery set of wings.
Tyson!
I yelled. The lifeboats had managed to get away from the ship, but not very far. Flaming wreckage was raining down. Clarice and Annabeth would either be smashed or burned or pulled to the bottom by the force of the sinking hull, and that was thinking optimistically, assuming they got away from Scylla. Then I heard a different kind of explosion, the sound of Hermes' magic thermos being opened a little too far. White sheets of wind blasted in every direction, scattering the lifeboats, lifting me out of my free fall and propelling me across the ocean. I couldn't see anything. I spun in the air, got clunked on the head by something hard, and hit the water with a crash that would have broken every bone in my body if I hadn't been the son of the sea god. The last thing I remembered was sinking in a burning sea, knowing that Tyson was gone forever, and wishing I were able to drown. Chapter 12. We check into Cece's spa and resort. I woke up in a rowboat with a makeshift sail stitched of gray uniform fabric. Annabeth sat next to me, tacking into the wind. I tried to sit up and immediately felt woozy.
Rest, she said. You're going to need it.
Tyson. She shook her head.
Percy, I'm really sorry.
We were silent while the waves tossed us up and down.
He may have survived, she said half-heartedly. I mean, fire can't kill him.
I nodded, but I had no reason to feel hopeful. I'd seen that explosion rip through solid iron. If Tyson had been down in the boiler room, there was no way he could have lived. He'd given his life for us. And all I could think about were the times I'd felt embarrassed by him and had denied that the two of us were related. Waves lapped at the boat. Annabeth showed me some things she'd salvaged from the wreckage. Hermes' thermos, now empty, a Ziploc bag full of ambrosia, a couple of sailors' shirts, and a bottle of Dr. Pepper. She'd fished me out of the water and found my knapsack, bitten in half by Scylla's teeth. Most of my stuff had floated away, but I still had Hermes' bottle of multivitamins, and of course I had Riptide. The ballpoint pen always appeared back in my pocket no matter where I lost it. We sailed for hours. Now that we were in the Sea of Monsters, the water glittered a more brilliant green, like hydro acid. The wind smelled fresh and salty, but it carried a strange metallic scent, too, as if a thunderstorm were coming, or something even more dangerous. I knew what direction we needed to go. I knew we were exactly 113 nautical miles west by northwest of our destination, but that didn't make me feel any less lost. No matter which way we turned, the sun seemed to shine straight into my eyes. We took turns sipping from the Dr. Pepper, shading ourselves with the sail as best we could, and we talked about my latest dream of Grover. By Annabeth's estimate, we had less than 24 hours to find Grover, assuming my dream was accurate, and assuming the Cyclops Polyphemus didn't change his mind and try to marry Grover earlier. "Yeah," I said bitterly. "You can never trust a Cyclops." Annabeth stared across the water. "I'm sorry, Percy. I was wrong about Tyson, okay? I wish I could tell him that." I tried to stay mad at her, but it wasn't easy. We'd been through a lot together. She'd saved my life plenty of times. It was stupid of me to resent her. I looked down at our measly possessions, the empty wind thermos, the bottle of multivitamins. I thought about Luke's look of rage when I tried to talk to him about his dad. "Annabeth, what's Chiron's prophecy?" She pursed her lips. "Percy, I shouldn't..." "I know Chiron promised the gods he wouldn't tell me, but you didn't promise, did you? Knowledge isn't always good for you. Your mom is the wisdom goddess." "I know, but every time heroes learn the future, they try to change it, and it never works. The gods are worried about something I'll do when I get older," I guessed. "Something when I turn 16. Annabeth twisted her Yankees cap in her hands. "Percy, I don't know the full prophecy, but it warns about a half-blood child of the big three. The next one who lives to the age of 16, that's the real reason Zeus, Poseidon, and Hades swore a pact after World War II not to have any more kids. The next child of the big three who reaches 16 will be a dangerous weapon." "Why?" "Because that hero will decide the fate of Olympus. He or she will make a decision that either saves the age of the gods or destroys it." I'd let that sink in. I don't get seasick, but suddenly I felt ill. "That's why Kronos didn't kill me last summer." She nodded. "You could be very useful to him. If he can get you on his side, the gods will be in serious trouble." "But if it's me in the prophecy, we'll only know that if you survive 3 more years. That can be a long time for a half-blood. When Chiron first learned about Thalia, he assumed she was the one in the prophecy. That's why he was so desperate to get her safely to camp. Then she went down fighting and got turned into a pine tree, and none of us knew what to think. Until you came along." On our port side, a spiky green dorsal fin about 15 feet long curled out of the water and disappeared. "This kid in the prophecy, he or she couldn't be like a Cyclops," I asked. "The big three have lots of monster children." Annabeth shook her head. "The oracle said half-blood. That always means half-human, half-god. There's really nobody alive who it could be except you." "Then why do the gods even let me live? It would be safer to kill me." "You're right. Thanks a lot." "Percy, I don't know. I guess some of the gods would like to kill you, but they're probably afraid of offending Poseidon. Other gods, maybe they're still watching you trying to decide what kind of hero you're going to be. You could be a weapon for their survival after all. The real question is, what will you do in 3 years? What decision will you make?" "Did the prophecy give any hints?" Annabeth hesitated. Maybe she would have told me more, but just then a seagull swooped down out of nowhere and landed on our makeshift mast. Annabeth looked startled as the bird dropped a small cluster of leaves into her lap. "Land," she said. "There's land nearby." I sat up. Sure enough, there was a line of blue and brown in the distance. Another minute, and I could make out an island with a small mountain in the center, a dazzling white collection of buildings, a beach dotted with palm trees, and a harbor filled with a strange assortment of boats. The current was pulling our rowboat toward what looked like a tropical paradise.
"Welcome," said the lady with the clipboard. She looked like a flight attendant, blue business suit, perfect makeup, hair pulled back in a ponytail. She shook our hands as we stepped onto the dock. With the dazzling smile she gave us, you would have thought we'd just gotten off the Princess Andromeda rather than a banged-up rowboat. Then again, our rowboat wasn't the weirdest ship in port. Along with a bunch of pleasure yachts, there was a U.S. Navy submarine, several dugout canoes, and an old-fashioned three-masted sailing ship. There was a helipad with a Channel 5 Fort Lauderdale helicopter on it, and a short runway with a Learjet and a propeller plane that looked like a World War II fighter. Maybe they were replicas for tourists to look at or something.
"Is this your first time with us?"
the clipboard lady inquired. Annabeth and I exchanged looks. Annabeth said,
"First time at spa," the lady said as she wrote on her clipboard. "Let's see."
She looked us up and down critically.
An herbal wrap to start for the young lady, and of course, a complete makeover for the young gentleman.
What? I asked. She was too busy jotting down notes to answer.
Right, she said with a breezy smile. Well, I'm sure Cece will want to speak with you personally before the luau. Come, please.
Now, here's the thing. Annabeth and I were used to traps, and usually those traps looked good at first, so I expected the clipboard lady to turn into a snake or a demon or something any minute. But on the other hand, we'd been floating in a rowboat for most of the day. I was hot, tired, and hungry, and when this lady mentioned a luau, my stomach sat up on its hind legs and begged like a dog.
"I guess it couldn't hurt," Annabeth muttered.
Of course it could, but we followed the lady anyway. I kept my hands in my pockets where I'd stashed my only magic defenses, Hermes multivitamins and Riptide. But the farther we wandered into the resort, the more I forgot about them. The place was amazing. There was white marble and blue water everywhere I looked. Terraces climbed up the side of the mountain with swimming pools on every level, connected by water slides and waterfalls and underwater tubes you could swim through. Fountains sprayed water into the air, forming impossible shapes like flying eagles and galloping horses. Tyson loved horses, and I knew he'd love those fountains. I almost turned around to see the expression on his face before I remembered Tyson was gone.
"You okay?"
Annabeth asked me.
"You look pale."
"I'm okay," I lied. "Just let's keep walking." We passed all kinds of tame animals. A sea turtle napped in a stack of beach towels. A leopard stretched out asleep on a diving board. The resort guests, only young women as far as I could see, lounged in deck chairs, drinking fruit smoothies or reading magazines while herbal gunk dried in their faces, and manicurists in white uniforms did their nails. As we headed up a staircase toward what looked like the main building, I heard a woman singing. Her voice drifted through the air like a lullaby. Her words were in some language other than ancient Greek, but just as old. Minoan, maybe, or something like that. I could understand what she sang about. Moonlight in the olive groves, the colors of the sunrise, and magic. Something about magic. Her voice seemed to lift me off the steps and carry me toward her. We came into a big room where the whole front wall was windows. The back wall was covered in mirrors, so the room seemed to go on forever. There was a bunch of expensive-looking white furniture, and on a table in one corner was a large wire pet cage. The cage seemed out of place, but I didn't think about it too much because just then I saw the lady who'd been singing, and whoa! She sat at a loom the size of a big screen TV, her hands weaving colored thread back and forth with amazing skill. The tapestry shimmered like it was three-dimensional. A waterfall seemed so real, I could see the water moving and clouds drifting across a fabric sky. Annabeth caught her breath. It's beautiful. The woman turned. She was even prettier than her fabric. Her long, dark hair was braided with threads of gold. She had piercing green eyes, and she wore a silky black dress with shapes that seemed to move in the fabric. Animal shadows, black upon black, like deer running through a forest at night.
You appreciate weaving, my dear? The woman asked.
Oh, yes, ma'am, Annabeth said. My mother is... She stopped herself. You couldn't just go around announcing that your mom was Athena, the goddess who invented the loom. Most people would lock you in a rubber room. Our hostess just smiled. You have good taste, my dear. I'm so glad you've come. My name is Cece.
The animals in the corner cage started squealing. They must have been guinea pigs, from the sound of them.
We introduced ourselves to Cece. She looked me over with a twinge of disapproval, as if I'd failed some kind of test. Immediately, I felt bad. For some reason, I really wanted to please this lady.
Oh, dear, she sighed. You do need my help.
Ma'am? I asked. Cece called to the lady in the business suit.
Hilla, take Annabeth on a tour, will you? Show her what we have available. The clothing will need to change. And the hair, my goodness. We will do a full image consultation after I've spoken with this young gentleman.
But... Annabeth's voice sounded hurt.
What's wrong with my hair?
Cece smiled benevolently.
My dear, you are lovely, really. But you're not showing off yourself or your talents at all. So much wasted potential.
Wasted?
Well, surely you're not happy the way you are. My goodness, there's not a single person who is. But don't worry, we can improve anyone here at the spa. Hilla will show you what I mean. You, my dear, need to unlock your true self.
Annabeth's eyes glowed with longing. I'd never seen her so much at a loss for words.
But what about Percy?
Oh, definitely, Cece said, giving me a sad look. Percy requires my personal attention. He needs much more work than you. Normally, if somebody had told me that, I would have gotten angry. But when Cece said it, I felt sad. I disappointed her. I had to figure out how to do better.
The guinea pigs squealed like they were hungry.
Well, Annabeth said, I suppose...
Right this way, dear, Hilla said.
And Annabeth allowed herself to be led away into the waterfall-laced gardens of the spa. Cece took my arm and guided me toward the mirrored wall.
You see, Percy, to unlock your potential, you'll need serious help. The first step is admitting that you're not happy the way you are.
I fidgeted in the front of the mirror. I hated thinking about my appearance, like the first zit that had cropped up on my nose at the beginning of the school year, or the fact that my two front teeth weren't perfectly even, or that my hair never stayed down straight.
Cece's voice brought all of these things to mind as if she were passing me under a microscope. And my clothes were not cool. I knew that. Who cares, part of me thought. But standing in front of Cece's mirror, it was hard to see anything good in myself.
There, there, Cece consoled. How about we try this?
She snapped her fingers and a sky blue curtain rolled down over the mirror. It shimmered like the fabric on her loom.
What do you see? Cece asked.
I looked at the blue cloth, not sure what she meant.
I don't...
Then it changed colors. I saw myself. A reflection, but not a reflection. Shimmering there on the cloth was a cooler version of Percy Jackson, with just the right clothes, a confident smile on my face, my teeth were straight, no zits... A perfect tan, more athletic, maybe a couple of inches taller. It was me without the faults.
Whoa, I managed.
Do you want that?
Cece asked.
Well, shall I try a different...
No, I said. That's amazing. Can you really...
I can give you a full makeover,
Cece promised.
What's the